Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go to bbc.co.uk/5live.
Mark Kermode is here, Richard E. Grant is here, and it's always nice when Richard comes around. And this particular movie, I feel great about because Mark hasn't seen it. And I have, and that's that very rarely happens. Is it a good week for? I mean, apart from the Da Vinci thing, is there anything else comes out, or do the major studios think we better just hold back?
There is other stuff out, but obviously the Da Vinci Code is kind of, you know, carpet bombed cinema. So it's whatever anyone says, it's going to be number one next week, and probably going to be number one, you know, for a period ahead. And it's worth saying in advance that they don't care. Richard was just saying, you know, do they mind what the critics say? They don't care. It's like, you know, invading a small country. They don't care what anyone says about it. It's there. It's already, it has arrived. Thank you very much.
But there aren't that many critic-proof movies, are there, Richard? I would think where they've sold many copies.
Titanic was the one that was critic-proof, wasn't it?
Yeah, and the Star Wars movies. I mean, the Star Wars movies are a perfect example. Yeah. You say what you like about George Lucas, and let's say it, he couldn't direct Traffic, and he should get out from behind the camera and just sit back and produce, which is what he does well. Nothing that anyone says would have damaged that. The fact that The Phantom Menace, which you saw with me in America, and I think you agree with Johan, he's one of the great turkeys of all time, took record-breaking amounts of money. Hudson Hawk, I don't think did take very much money, though, did it, Richard?
No, it didn't. You keep bringing it up.
I know.
I'm going to throw it back at
you. I love that film, and you hate it. You're in it. I thought it was funny.
Well, just that I've been walloped over the head ever since it was made 15 years ago.
Not by me. I like that film.
Yeah, good for you.
David in Brighton, Love with Nails, Richard, particularly the hilarious stories about the making of Hudson Hawk. Back right. One of the great things about the book was that it didn't seem airbrushed or censored in any way. Did you lose any friends when it came out? Did any of the actors mentioned in it react negatively or threaten legal action?
Well, not that I know, but put it this way. I've never been asked to work on another Joel Silver Bruce Willis action picture before, but considering my lack of musculature, I'm sure that is unlikely. So, you know, nothing I could have said about
Hugh Grant. Still say hi?
Yes, I've seen him since. Yep.
Just checking.
The phrase that you used when I asked you about it, and I said I quite like that film, and you said, "Well, you're an imbecile." And I said, "It's a good film." You said, "It's a steaming hot pile of elephants dropping."
Right. Oh well, there you go. Well, most of the critics thought the same.
And Kim Newman laughed all the way through.
Well, until Waterworld and Last Action Hero and The Postman came out in the mid-90s, that was considered, you know, the turkey of the decade. Yeah.
So it really does it, what do you think, does it really matter about what critics make of Wawa? Because it is one of the movies that people think, I'll go and see it because I like Richard E. Grant, I'll wait and see what people think about it, word of mouth.
Absolutely crucial what critics think, because it was made for $7 million, so it doesn't have a big juggernaut of publicity or big studio behind
it. But that's next to nothing, isn't it?
So you have got to, you know, get on your hind legs and do anything you can to try and promote the movie, because it'll have a limited release. So, you know, trying to get it to cross over or even break out or last, you know, that's always the struggle for any independent film.
Can I just ask you about one other incident? You mentioned some of the extraordinary events in your life, and you mentioned your father's funeral, with which the film ends. However, it doesn't really portray what happened. I mean, the version of your father's funeral, which you just hinted at, is not the way the funeral works out in the movie.
DVD extras. But what actually happened, as you know, when I spoke to you about this before, that a young Swazi priest who'd just come back from the States, believing that he could raise people from the dead from this evangelical course that he'd been on, jumped into the grave, opened the lid, tried to raise my father, and then, you know, he was dead. He then the priest had to be dragged out and consoled that, you know, his faith had somehow deserted him at this point in time. But so we shot all of this, and when we showed it to preview audiences before the film was finally locked off in the edit, they said this may have happened in real life, but it's too bonkers and too off-kilter that we just can't take it to this point, because we need that character, who's my father in the story, to go through a clean emotional line and die. So it'll be in the DVD outtake extras of scenes. But there was a case of the reality proving too much for the audience at that point in time, so it is a straightforward, conventional burial.
Because the extraordinary thing, which I will remember and you won't, is that I was at university with that guy's brother, the guy who jumped in.
Becky Gumedze's brother, yeah.
That's right. And I was at university with Temma Gumedze. I shared a room with him for a year.
Unbelievable.
And that's, I mean, I don't know whether that's just
what are the chances of that?
The fact that Swaziland is a really small place.
Yeah, it is.
And I remember, because I heard him say it a couple of times on the phone, I know how to say good night, mum and dad, in Siswati, which is the language of Swaziland.
Go on.
Well, I think if I remembered it right, it's Lalagache Maginibaba.
Lalagache Maginibaba.
You see, that sounds so much better.
What he was actually saying was, my roommate really smells.
No, that's not true.
But it is the most extraordinary story. But I can see how that wouldn't have worked in the film, because you do have that sense of okay, that's the story finished at the end of the movie.
Yeah, you can't. People said they didn't know whether to laugh or to cry or at what it was doing at that point. So, you know, DVD extras, thank God for them.
And have you done your director's commentary already?
I haven't yet, no. I have to get the film out first.
When we hear about Swaziland now, it's always connected to the HIV/AIDS story, which they have suffered with particularly. Why is there a particular problem?
Well, I'll tell you why, because it's the 58% of the population of 1 million people are now HIV positive. And the reason, I think, is because it's a polygamous culture where people have more than one husband, more than one wife, should I say, led by the king who has many wives, and that is part of the polygamous culture. So to tell people, unlike leprosy, that your dick is going to fall off if you do this, because it takes 5 to 7 years for the thing to manifest itself, and the philosophy there is basically, tomorrow's another day. It's taken a long time, and the majority of people don't have television, and so it's not a media saturated culture like we have in the West. So I think that for people to get information is very difficult, and many rural people rely on witch doctors who bleed people and use infected razor blades from one to another. So, you can find that you go in for a headache and you HIV positive infected within, an hour of going in there.
I mean, presumably with an infection rate that high, the whole of the society must be at risk, mustn't it? If it's 58%.
Yeah, so out of 1 million people, theoretically in 10 years' time, because they don't have the antiretroviral drugs that we have available here, half the population will be gone. So there's an enormous and increasing population of orphan kids. So we're using the money from the premiere of the film, both here in South Africa and in Swaziland, to raise money for AIDS hospices there.
Does it have to come from the king, do you think?
It would have to, because he's an absolute monarch, and it's a country that is one tribe, one language. So it really would have to be led by him.
So the premiere is it initially open here, or is it initially open in South Africa?
It's just open in the States last weekend, and then the premiere is here on Tuesday, the 30th of May, in Leicester Square, and then it opens around the country on the 2nd of June. And then the premiere, and then I go to Australia, and then it opens in South Africa in the middle of June. Swaziland doesn't have a cinema anymore, so we'll have an outdoor screening on a wall.
So the last picture show that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, the cinema burnt down, and they got television in 1980, and as a result, nobody went to the movies anymore. So they never reopened it. It's now a bike shop.
How extraordinary!
Yeah.
What do they make of it in the States? Have you heard?
Yes, I was there for the premieres, and having thought that it had to be, the wisdom here was that it's a British film dealing with colonialism and a British cast, that you would have to have some kind of connection to get what it is. But having been to Toronto, Palm Springs, Dallas, Tribeca in New York, and Los Angeles last week, where Steve Martin hosted a screening and Q&A, where you really get feedback from the audience there and then, people laughed, and you could really hear them crying at the end, which was an incredibly satisfying reaction, because I realized that the bottom line is that the film is about family. You take away the idiosyncrasies of its colonial setting, but it's about what goes on behind closed doors, as opposed to the public show of how people are, and addiction, adultery, divorce, all this stuff, amateur dramatics that go on in the story. They are things that so many people have experienced. So,
and has there been a reconciliation with your mother?
Yeah, completely. Yeah, as a result of writing the film, really, that has brought about after a 35-year estrangement, because for the first time I heard from her in a very long letter explaining what and how and why she left when she did, because, apart from being 10 years old and her coming at 6 o'clock in the morning saying, you don't need to go to school today, I'm leaving, and you can go on a school's inspection trip with your father, because he was the director of education for the country. I never, ever had a proper explanation from her why and how she did what she did. So it has been very healing from that point of view.
Has she seen the movie?
She hasn't yet, but she read the script. And my stepmother has seen it. She saw it at a film festival and thought that it was amazing. So she thought the script is really well written, and she said that she thought that it very compassionately showed what that time was like to live in. So, but she hasn't seen it yet. I mean, you know, what her reaction will be when she actually sees Miranda Richardson playing her bonking in the front seat of a car on the opening scene of the film is another hurdle to cross. But, yes. You know, she knows that that's what's in there.
Are you quite nervous about how it will be perceived, this film, or how what the reaction is, what the reviews say, how much money it takes? I mean, this is
high risk. Oh, yeah,
because
this affects my, you know, my future to be, you know, to do any more writing, directing. Although I know from the reaction and the majority of the critics that I've had already in America that the film really works, and it works with an audience. And the people who haven't liked it are the people who don't like coming-of-age stories because they have inherent clichés and story points that come in every coming-of-age story. But I've been absolutely bowled over by the response, quite honestly. And the thing is, to go back to what you were asking me, I can't... If I'm an actor, I've just done a film playing a part opposite Catherine O'Hara with Christina Ricci and Reese Witherspoon in a movie called Penelope, which comes out at the end of this year. And being an actor for hire, you have no real responsibility other than you turn up, you do your lines, you know, and how they cut or edit you or whatever is somebody else's decision. Whereas if you write, direct, and, you know, practically co-produce something, there's nobody else to blame. And if it's about your own life, if people hate it and you, therefore, you know, I can't say, oh, well, you know, it's my interpretation of the life of Mark Kermode. It's, you know, it's me fairly and squarely. So there's no place to hide like Batman, really.
I don't know how often you... the other great thing, first appearance in a movie of a snake belt for a very long time. I haven't seen a snake belt. I used to have one. Remember those belts?
Yeah, sure, kind of
snake belts. S-snake? Was that... Wardrobe did a terrific job.
Oh, they just had to go to my old school and get the uniform.
That was fantastic. Anyway, I thought it was a terrific movie. And we'll
thank
find out what Mark... Because I'm ahead of Mark, so he has got no idea what we're talking about.
Good, well, maybe that's lucky.
In the audience of two that I was watching it in, we thought it was absolutely fantastic.
Oh, thank you, Simon.
I've got the box office top 10, which I read out, and then Mark does like a sentence on each.
You're
okay.
Lucky.
Are you likely to have seen many of these? Because I want you to join in this.
Okay.
Right. So, reviews to come. However, this is the box office top 10 with reviews from Mark and then occasional interjections where appropriate by Richard E. Grant. At number 10, Scary Movie 4.
Wasn't funny the first time, the second time, the third time, or guess what, the fourth time.
Oh, but the farting scene is as good as Blazing Saddles.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
Now, that counts as quality argument. She's the Man at 9.
Well, actually, over to you, Simon, because Simon's daughter thinks it's... What's the quote?
The best movie ever.
The best, and I'm not going to argue with her.
Right. Haven't seen it.
Hey, come on, Mr. Spice World.
Yeah, exactly. You were saying,
all right. I haven't seen it yet.
The 8-year-olds. I'm right. Sorry.
I'm going. Are you?
I'm going, boys.
Slacking.
Brick at 8.
It's interesting. It's a good kind of Dashiell Hammett goes to high school. It's not quite the masterpiece that everybody says it is, but considering it was made for, I think it's like $500,000.
Wow. That makes Richard's movie
exactly
Hollywood style.
Exactly. Titanic.
God, if I get to number 3, I'll be absolutely full of bricks myself.
16 Blocks at 7.
It's a B movie with an A-list cast. Bruce Willis shambles in that way that he does, and we have not yet arrived at a definitive reading of Mos Def's real name, but I'm settling for Gertrude Stein.
Have you seen that, Richard?
No.
Okay. Well, give us an opinion anyway.
Okay.
It's got Bruce Willis in it.
Yeah, because you worked with Bruce Willis on Hudson Hawk. Sorry to bring it up again, but you just did.
Top Man.
And in which they had to animate his hair because he thought he was too bald.
Great sense of humour. He's a fantastic guy.
Good, that'll do. Silent Hill at 6.
Rubbish. Movies based on computer games. Rubbish. This just proves the point. And it's a shame because Christoph Gans is actually a good visual stylist, but this is rubbish.
Ditto.
Confetti at 5.
I thought it was funny.
And it's a British movie.
Yeah, did
in
you
the
hate
top
it?
10. I think it's fantastic.
No,
it's a British
it.
Movie and improvised. New people.
Did
and
you
it's
see
great.
It?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. It's entertaining. It's
really
you know,
good.
It's not perfect, but for an improvised movie about three weddings with, you know, one of the gags being that one of the weddings is nudist, it's much more laughs than you'd expect.
Ice Age 2, The Meltdown at 4.
Individually funny sketches. Agreed. With no narrative coherence whatsoever and no story, but I noticed that nobody has yet emailed in to say that they have tried the challenge that we set 3 weeks ago, which is walking out of Ice Age saying very loudly, I think it's the death of narrative cinema, and seeing how it goes down with the under 10s. You should try it.
All right, I will.
When a Stranger Calls, number 3.
When a Stranger Calls the first time round was not very good, although it did have 20 minutes of quite good stuff at the beginning. When a Stranger Calls Back, the sequel, I haven't seen. It was a made-for-TV movie, but I have now ordered it. But When a Stranger Calls, the remake, is absolute garbage. Absolute stinking. What was the phrase you used for Hudson Hawk? A big
pile of
steaming
elephant
hot pile of elephant droppings.
Right, okay.
You'll just go along with that, Richard, will you?
Yeah.
Okay. Prime at 2.
Meryl Streep.
Worse. No, but Meryl, right?
Meryl
Muriel Strepsil is the best thing in the film, and
Meryl
she's
Streep,
in a
fantastic.
Whole different. But have you seen Prime?
Oh, she's fantastic.
But have you seen Prime?
I have seen it, yeah.
Fine.
On an airplane.
Okay. Yeah, and people were still walking out. Boom, boom.
I'm just going to sleep.
Uma Thurman.
awful. Absolutely just transgressively bad,
like,
all the way
through.
She looks like Uma Thurman. She looks like somebody who stepped into a script because Sandra Bullock had said, you know what, I'm not doing this as it is. You have to allow me to rewrite the script.
Meryl
Streep is in another film.
Yeah, she is.
She's
absolutely
in a film about a funny Jewish mum,
yeah,
which is not the film about Uma Thurman and the
Look, don't
know,
argue with him. He's
kid.
Richard E.
Now,
Grant.
Mission Impossible 3, how is this? My movie premieres in New York and it's preceded by Mission Impossible 3. He arrives in Manhattan, Tom Cruise, on a helicopter, gets on a subway that's been hired, then gets on a fire engine, brings the whole city practically to a standstill. Streets are closed off, including Broadway. So, you know, you try and get my movie Wawa out there. It's like sort of being a tadpole in a sea of killer sharks.
Sounds like the trailer for Mission Impossible 3 cost about the same as your whole movie.
Oh, more. I think Tom Cruise's, you know, Evian bill was, you know, up there with what my whole movie cost.
Mission Impossible 3?
Well, I thought of all the Mission Impossible films, it was the best one so far.
And Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Philip Seymour Hoffman is
very
good.
There's no such thing as
a bad Philip Seymour Hoffman movie. There is, you know, maybe such thing as a bad Richard E. Grant movie, but not generally. Although, you have been in a film with Julian Sands, which is obviously a sort of contradiction as to whether
Warlock.
Or not. Which one? Yeah, Warlock, the marvellous acting
Julian Sands. We've taken enough of your time, Richard. Thanks very much, Steve, for coming. It's been fantastic. Wish you all the best with the World Watch. I think it's terrific.
Thank you.
And what do we see you in next? You mentioned Penelope, isn't
that? Penelope, yeah. It was Christina Ricci and Reese Witherspoon, Catherine O'Hara, Out of Christmas.
Okay. Richard, thanks very much indeed.
Thank you, gents.
It's 5 Live at 3:21. I feel a Da Vinci Code conversation coming. Have you seen the Da Vinci Code, by the way?
No, I haven't. Punters, I was going to go tonight.
Okay.
But tell someone what you thought of the book.
I thought the first three quarters, absolute page turner, unstoppable, like the other 50 million people. And as soon as it said Jesus was royal and that his lineage and his sister and Mary Magdalene, I was like ready to barf. You loved it.
What, the book?
Yeah.
I found it, I quote Melvin Bragg. Melvin Bragg was on recently because he was talking about the 12 books that changed the world, which is a very interesting conversation. Yes, we're on. And
okay, we're still going.
They are broadcasting this.
Oh, my God.
Do you think we're off? Do you think we're off? No, we're still on. See that red light? We're still on.
God, so careful.
Okay, so we're still on. Melvin Bragg was on, and I said, what did you think? Because the court case had just been decided.
Yeah.
So I said, on the book
the court
of the
case
day, Melvin,
whether the book
think?
Was rubbish or not.
He said, I found it enthralling, and I would agree with that. It's not a great book, yeah. It's not great literature, but it is enthralling.
It's a page-turner.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I just read it right through, and then as soon as we got to all the Jesus stuff, I read it, I lost the plot.
Okay, yeah. So...
We're saying, you know, if the Da Vinci Code, when we got to the Jesus stuff, it's like saying, I really like The Godfather, but as soon as those gangsters turned up, it really went downhill.
Bring the head
of the horse.
Richard, I think we're done.
Okay. I'll creep back now.
Okay. So, movies out this week. There are others. Mm-hmm. Once in a Lifetime, The King, Waiting. We'll try and get to them. However, first of all, there's the small matter of the aforementioned Da Vinci Code.
Should we do Da Vinci Code first? Are you okay to start with that before?
Well, I don't know.
I'm happy
How long do you need for the Da Vinci
Code? Well,
what we could do is we could faff about with correspondence and something else.
Like I could do The King.
Okay, why don't we do The King?
Do The King, and then we'll do The Da Vinci Code after 2:30, because we need a little bit of space. 3:30. After 2:30. Is
okay.
That all right?
All right, so we do The King first, The Da Vinci Code in just a moment. Before we get to that, Peter Smith emails from Prague.
Yes.
Sam and Mark, thanks for accusing me of appearing in some computer game movie, as you did during last week's reviews, which I listened to this morning with your very good Listen Again feature. You remember this? We threw it at him.
Oh, yes, that's right. Well, he wasn't sure what film he'd appear
anyway,
in.
Anyway, but actually I was in a terminally naff mini TV series called Revelations, as it turned out. I played third newsreader, getting paid the princely sum of £250, although I did get the chance to wear Bill Pullman's shirt.
Oh, wow.
Apart from appearing in a Cold Remedy ad and actually turning down and then regretting the rather dubious opportunity to spend the day with a new 007, my acting career has kind of hit the rocks. So just to cheer myself up, I popped in earlier this week to a press screening of the film version of the extremely popular Dan Brown book. Take it away, Dr. Kermode, he says. So anyway, we'll get to that just after 3:30. You just have to hang on for that. Or if you're listening to the podcast, you could just fast forward.
Quick,
anyway.
Leap 5 minutes forward. Okay.
For the rest of us,
The King, which the first major English language role for Gael Garcia Bernal, who was the guy who starred in Amores Perros and Motorcycle Diaries, which was the film of the autobiography of Che Guevara, which is a terrifically good film, a really, really good piece of work that managed to marry the personal and the political, and had a really charismatic central performance by Gael Garcia Bernal, who's a very, very sort of interesting actor, looks brilliant on screen, has been compared to the new James Dean and certainly has some of that brooding power, I think. It's directed by British filmmaker James Marsh, who's probably best known for a movie he made a couple of years ago called Wisconsin Death Trip. The story is that Gael Garcia Bernal plays this character called Elvis, who comes out of the forces and turns up in Texas on the doorstep of William Hurt, who is a fundamentalist preacher. And he introduces himself to William Hurt as if William Hurt should know who he is, bringing with him the revelation of a dark secret in William Hurt's past. It's interesting because Gael Garcia Bernal was nominated in the recent BAFTA Awards, one of the Rising Star Awards, the Newcomer Awards. And I think he definitely has a stellar future ahead of him. He really is charismatic and enigmatic on screen. In that scene, you hear him playing with William Hurt, and I think William Hurt is a really underrated actor. One of the best things about William Hurt is he doesn't mind playing really unsympathetic roles, and yet he invests those roles with a genuine humanity. He doesn't play bad guys just simply as bad guys, and he's on top form here. Gael Garcia Bernal, working in the English language, I think is very good as well. The two of them are reason enough to go and see the film. The film itself has a quite interesting American Gothic feel to it. It's very, very heavy with a sense of mood and location. You can feel the hot Texas sun. You feel the sweat on the characters. And it, to some extent, evokes Badlands, which, I mean, Badlands is a classic movie, which, funnily enough, I watched again recently because Terrence Malick's new film, New World, has just come out on DVD, and I went back and watched Badlands, and it is a terrific piece of work. This is nothing like in the same league as Badlands. But what it does have is an interesting change between light and dark. When you first are introduced to Gael Garcia Bernal's character, you think he's innocent and wide-eyed and naive, but there's something slightly dangerous about him. And as the drama moves on, we get into strange areas of incest and murder and conspiracy, and the movie changes tone very, very gradually. If it wasn't for having those two very charismatic central performances, it probably wouldn't hang together half as well as it does. But he's terrific. As I said, the general mood of the piece is engrossing. It's really interesting in comparison with some of the other releases that are out this week to see a film in which the filmmaker is interested in situating the characters in a real, believable world and actually gives the drama time to develop properly. And I think on the basis of this, it's a very good calling card for him, and I would expect to see him now, you know, becoming a mainstream Hollywood star.
Da Vinci thoughts in just a moment. First, Peter, listening in Sydney, Australia, says, I always used to listen to your programme while sitting on the District Line on the Tube in London. Now I listen to it on a bus ride to work over Sydney Harbour Bridge because I listen via the podcast. Since the birth of my son, Joshua, on the 1st of May, my wife and I won't be seeing... Indeed. We won't be seeing too many films in the near future. It did make me wonder, age considerations aside, what would be the very first film Mark would recommend Josh to see to embark him on a lifetime's rewarding cinematic enjoyment? It is always a challenge.
Yeah.
And let's say not DVD.
Oh, you mean actually in the
cinema?
Well,
he doesn't say that, but I think this should be the first film based on current knowledge that you should take.
You mean based on films that are out at the moment?
Yeah. Well, not based on movies about to be made.
No. What I mean is, can it be like a anything. Mean, because I would say that the greatest starting point is Mary Poppins. And I do think that Mary Poppins is an absolutely fantastic film to start kids
with. First film I ever saw.
Well, there we go, and look how well you turned out.
And, there you go, conclusive proof. Okay, we'll just do that then. That's fair enough.
I mean, and I would also say, incidentally, I do think Mary Poppins is one of the 10 greatest movies ever made, and I think it you can watch it again from a parent's point of view, take your child to see it, because you particularly from a father's point of view, because so much of Mary Poppins is about the father coming to terms with the way he's lacking as a father. I mean, floods of tears all round, and it's absolutely wonderful. And the bit on the when the fireworks go off on the roof, when my sister was taken to see it, when she was a little kid at the Barnet Odeon, she stood on the chair and went, "Oh, isn't it pretty?" Which is something that my family had never forgotten.
Indeed, and doubtless that comes out every year.
It does, but you asked.
John in Hove, could you ask the good doctor, being a Terry Gilliam fan like myself, what he thinks of the rumour of Mr Gilliam directing the next Harry Potter? I believe it would be the greatest but least profitable Potter film ever.
Well, Gilliam was down to do Potter.
And I know he wants to do it because he told us, but...
Yeah, he was one of the original directors slated before Chris Columbus decided that he was going to mess it up for everyone else. It isn't... I mean, I would love to see Gilliam do it.
Is he back in the frame?
I don't know, because you never know these things until it actually happens. Gilliam did tell me a wonderful story about he got on a plane to go to America to have the interview about Harry Potter, and he knew he wasn't going to get it. And then he read the book on the plane. He said that by the time he got off the plane, the other end having read the book, he was desperate to get it because he really thought, I am made to do this. And then, of course, he went and did the interview and didn't get it.
And John's conclusion, it would be the greatest but probably least profitable.
Well, I don't know that that's true, because I wouldn't have thought that Alfonso Cuarón was a profitable director, but of course he did turn in the best Harry Potter movie. I mean, you thought the most recent one was
not as good as the third. Not the weakest, but
it's not as good as the third, but it is better than the Chris Columbus movie. I mean, at least they are now using proper filmmakers. I would love to see Gilliam do that, because clearly he is tailor-made for that stuff, and I think he'd do it well. Gilliam makes hits. You know, Time Bandits took money. Fisher King took money. 12 Monkeys took money.
This from Dom in London's NW10. My four-year-old son and I have just come back from seeing Ice Age 2. Mm. I couldn't quite remember what I was supposed to say, but on the way out, I did say quite loudly something along the lines of, that film and its ilk sound the death knell for narrative structure in Western cinema. My son agreed.
Good for him.
At four.
Yeah, good.
Unfortunately, it was a very poorly attended showing, and we were the only people in the cinema this afternoon. Does that still count? Do I get a prize?
Yeah, I think that does count.
I think you probably should.
Yeah. What we got?
Well, how about your press pack for the Da Vinci Code?
Yeah, you have. Take. Should we do the Da Vinci Code?
I think we probably should. We can't hang on that much.
No. Okay, so as you all know, it's the long-awaited and just plain long adaptation of Dan Brown's best-selling novel about religious symbology and flagellating priests and a conspiracy of silence around various religious organisations. Now, first things first, OK, let's establish the ground rules. One, it's not meant to be based on fact. People getting upset about it because, oh, it's factually wrong. Don't be silly. People in the Catholic Church, you know, members of the Vatican saying, boycott this movie, don't be silly. Foolish, very silly. I'm sure there was rejoicing in the PR office.
It's a novel.
It's a novel, and now it's a pulp film, OK? So please, let's just not even do that. The book itself, I wanted to read because I was given a copy of it for my birthday, and the person who gave it to me said, you're going to love this. It's got all the things you like. It's got religion, it's got flagellation, it's got conspiracy, it's complete nonsense. You know, and I read 30 pages of it before hurling it across the room, not because I had any objection to the story, but because I just thought it was unreadably bad. The main unreadably bad thing about it was that nobody had ever explained to Dan Brown the principle of the internal monologue, being that in books, when characters walk into rooms, they don't have to actually say who they are. Moreover, they don't have to actually out loud introduce themselves to people who they have known for the last 20 years. Dan, you can do that just internally. But he literally has people ring up saying, hello, my name's Jeff. You and I have been on this case for the last 25 years. Now I think we've got a break in the case. You remember the one we were talking about with the thing with the paintings and the guy with the...
Blah. Are we reviewing the book or the movie?
No.
We're still on the book.
Yes, I'm just saying to get that out of the way, okay?
Fine.
Then along comes Ron Howard, who I like as a filmmaker. I think Ron Howard is a very good filmmaker. I think Apollo 13 is a great movie. Splash is a great movie. Backdraft is a functional, you know, fireman action movie. Even the stuff of his that is ponderous, top-end stuff like A Beautiful Mind, I still think that there are flashes of brilliance in it. I'm a great respecter of him. So I went to see The Da Vinci Code thinking, the book, tripe, rubbish. But hey, as Richard E. Grant said, some people find it page-turning tripe. And if there's anyone going to turn this into a good popcorn potboiler, it's Ron Howard.
And it's got, and from the look of the poster, it's got Paul Bettany playing Darth Maul.
Yeah,
and that has to be quite...
You know, I love Paul Bettany. I think Paul, but the idea of Paul Bettany as a self-flagellating albino monk... are we saying albino or albino?
I think everyone else says albino.
You say tomato and I say tomato?
No. Everybody says albino, I think.
I open the email lines
in
to
the
people
real
say
world.
Albino. Okay. Oh, this is real world.
We're in
real world now. Okay, fine.
Tell us what you think of the film.
Firstly, none of us were shown the film till 9 o'clock on a Wednesday afternoon, until Wednesday evening, which meant we all finished at 11:30. So the best way of seeing Da Vinci Code would be 10:30 in the morning with three large shots of caffeine in you, because you know
no one sees movies at 10:30.
No, I know they don't. But you know that old rule about any film that's over 2 hours long, your head goes with it, but your bum gives up. Well, frankly, my bum gave up a long time before the 2 hours, and by the time my bum gave up, my head had departed the building. My hair was reeling in horror from the shape of Tom Hanks's haircut, and my eyes were tired with looking at the darkness that was on screen, thinking, turn the light on! I know it's a dark... For heaven's sake, Ron, just get a spotlight. You know, somebody switch the light switch on. Now, it is possible that within the Dan Brown potboiler, there is an intriguing theological thriller to be made. I love the theological thriller genre. Legion is one of my favourite novels, and I like The Exorcist 3 very much. Okay, theological thriller's great. The problem with this is, It's no fun. No fun whatsoever. It consists of people walking into dark rooms, looking at paintings, talking as if they have in their hand the Observer book of Leonardo da Vinci, and then explaining the plot to each other before doing a bit of chasing, and then stopping, and then doing some more explaining, and then a bit more chasing, and then stopping, and almost all of it in the dark. About halfway through, Sir Ian McKellen turns up, and he gets the best bit in the movie. He gets the 10-minute bit when he points to the very, very famous painting of The Last Supper and says, "Oh, you know what? That person in the middle looks a bit like a girl." And you go, "Actually, it does look a bit like a girl." Bingo! That's the whole of the central nub of the thing. The person on Jesus's right in The Last Supper looks a bit like a girl, and you know what? There's no grail in it. So guess what? Maybe the girl... Fine! That section... I mean, 12 minutes in total. And then we're back to the running and the people coming in and explain. Every single thing is explained by any character. Nothing is allowed to happen without somebody coming on, either in an actual French accent or, in the case of Paul Bettany, and I... Bless Paul Bettany. I love Paul Bettany. The accent that he's doing makes you think that he should be bringing you some more garlic bread with that, sir. I mean, it is the comedy... Italian-y, waitery accent. There's a scene in it in which Paul Bettany is standing naked in front of a mirror, flagellating himself with this dyed white hair and mad staring eyes. And I'm thinking, why am I so bored by this? Why am I feeling bits of my body atrophying as I... How can Ron Howard, the man who up until now has never made a boring film, how can he have been reduced to... It's like... dodging through treacle. You could see the waves of boredom, you know, buffeting themselves over the audience at the Empire. Every now and then, something on the soundtrack would go, da-dum! And it was like watching the Poseidon Adventure. It was like a tidal wave of, oh, people waking up. Oh, no, sir, where are we? Oh, no, we're still in the same museum with the bit with the photo. Yeah, and you know what? Yes, that does look a bit like a girl in the middle of the painting. Audrey Tautou, in her most annoying French wave. Oh, I am a detective, but my hair will never go out of place. Because anyway, we discover later on why it will never go out of place, because she has in fact been touched by the hand of divinity. Tom, in that haircut, walking into rooms, looking a bit confused, then solving puzzles, which open the door to more puzzles. Sir Ian McKellen treating the whole thing exactly as it's meant to have been treated, playing pantomime dame, but just... I mean, he's the only person who actually gets anything good to do. And Paul Bettany, what a waste of a great talent there is. I mean, Paul Bettany is a great, great actor, and he's done great work with Ron Howard. I mean, I would be surprised if a duller movie is released this year. I don't care about the theological debate. I don't care about the hoo-ha about whether or not it's true. I don't care about the defamation of the, you know, certain sections of the... I don't care about any of that. Just make the thing move forward. Turn the light on and stop talking so much.
That's a bit rich. And on the plus side?
Yeah, but I'm not a film. On the plus side? No, nothing, actually. Absolutely nothing. Not even Paul Bettany.
Who plays the albino.
Who plays the albino monk.
The deal on that is, because if you look up for pronunciation, it says either is acceptable. However, what happens is the Americans say albino, British people say albino.
Let's call the whole thing off.
I mean, you can say aluminum if you want, but you're just wrong.
Yeah, or nuclear.
85058, mayo@bbc.co.uk. David in Brighton. Hi, guys. When Mark exploded into shouting just now during his review of Da Vinci Code, he made my neighbours bang on the wall. Sweet revenge for all their late night parties. I thank you. So turn the radio up.
I had planned to be sober about it, because actually I thought the best way of summing up that movie is to be sober. And that's the funny thing is the complete disjunct between how annoyed I am by it and how dull it is. I mean, believe me, what I just told you is more exciting than anything in the film.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how bad it is.
Do you think that you and the critics were, if you're honest, just so hacked off at being shown this film very, very late that actually if you'd been, you know, if you went to see it properly, you'd actually be well disposed?
That's a very good question, and I have a
now, you remember the Millennium Dome got all those rubbish reviews because all the journalists who went to see it, they were kept waiting
No, listen. The last time we weren't shown a movie till very late was War of the Worlds, and what a shock. Turned out to be one of Spielberg's best movies, really, really good. I went into The Da Vinci Code thinking, I want this to be really good. I like Ron Howard. I know that everyone, all the broadsheets are going to sniff and burble at it because that's what they're going to do. I want to be the dissenting voice who says, you know what, you guys don't know anything. It's a great popcorn pot boiler. It's got Paul Bettany, it's got Tom Hanks. I wanted to like it. I promise you, I wanted to find something nice to say about it. Because I like Ron Howard. I like Paul Bettany. I like Tom Hanks. I like the ideas of the thing. I just hated the book just because it was badly written by somebody who clearly, you know, thinks that the phone directory is some indication of a literary criticism course. But the depression that I felt as I realised that Ron had stodged it up was awe-inspiring. I mean, believe me, if anyone was going to like it, it was me.
Don't forget the podcasts which are available. There's two that you can subscribe to, Mark's Movie Review, so you can enjoy every single syllable and adjust volume accordingly. And there's also the podcast of the daily version of this programme, which you can get on the Five Live website, or you can get it on iTunes. You're looking for the Daily Mail or Mark Kermode's Film Reviews. I think, in case you missed the Richard E. Grant and Dawn French interview, that's what will be on our podcast today. All the details on the Five Live website. This from Marianne in Newcastle. Pirates of the Caribbean or The Da Vinci Code?
Pirates of the Caribbean. And I'm not joking. Well, really. And that's a very good question, and I think that tells you everything you need to know.
On the subject of best first films to go to, we were just talking about earlier. Yeah. This is the very first cinematic experience for a child. This is from Joanna. My friend took her son to see Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
Really?
When he was a few months old.
Oh, yeah, but that doesn't count,
followed
really.
By Natural Born Killers a couple of weeks later.
Well, they shouldn't have been allowed into the cinema.
But is there a different rule if you're like a... I mean, obviously, it's a fairly stupid thing to do anyway, but if you're a few months old, you can see anything, can't you?
No, but the law says if you're under... Well, it's meant to say if you're under 18, you can't come in. If you're under 15, you can't come in. It's 12. No, people are not meant to take babies into cinemas, and taking a baby in to see Natural Born Killers under any circumstances is pretty shocking, because they'll end up thinking that all films are that shouty.
But Joanna does say no son is growing up to be a cross-dressing serial killer on the basis of that. Nick in London, surely Wizard of Oz, far superior to child's first film than Mary Poppins. Dark. Yeah. It's darker. Well, you know, there comes a point where you don't really want dark, do you?
Wizard of Oz is a great film, but it is dark, and it is very... And a lot of kids get very wigged out by the flying monkeys, which is why I don't actually think it's a perfect
choice. And going
through
the Enchanted foresty bit is terrifying.
Yeah, I mean,
I think it
is a great piece. Personally, although I know it's heresy to say so, I actually prefer Mary Poppins, but also it's a safer bet. There's no point in scaring people just for the sake of it. Wizard of Oz is a terrific movie, but I think you have to be a little bit older to really get a handle on it.
Jungle Book?
Yeah, I like Jungle Book. It's nice. It's quite short. It's like 62 minutes long. And, of course, it was the last of the films made under the auspices of Walt, just before, you know, 67, 68. And then after that, the company went through... They went through the death of narrative cinema, in fact.
OK, if there are any better suggestions... I mean, it's quite an interesting one, actually. That someone ought to bring out, you know, best first film, a box set.
I'm sure somebody has
done. OK, so Da Vinci Code is going to clear up whatever anyone says. What else is out?
Once in a Lifetime, the documentary about the rise and fall of the New York... Cosmos, as opposed to Cosmos, because I didn't, you know, what do I know? I don't know nothing about
football.
It was
first in for free with Five Live.
It was. And I went into this thinking, well, I'm not going to enjoy this at all because, you know, I could care less about football. But in fact, it turned out to be a rip-roaringly entertaining documentary about the rise and fall of New York's premier football team. As you know, I have zip interest in football. But watching this, it was very interesting. You do start to feel a strange sense of national pride at the way the Americans think that the way of making it better would be to break it up into lots of different segments and having dancing girls and elephants and circuses on the pitch to make it more palatable. It's a terrific documentary. It's very, very entertaining, largely because it has some great characters in it. Pelé is featured in it but isn't interviewed for it. I think because Pelé himself is working on either his own biography or a documentary about his own life. This guy, who I presume you all are familiar with, Giorgio Chinaglia.
Yeah, he was on recently. By the way, on Pelé, Pelé is on the programme on Monday.
Oh, well, great. Fine.
Guest on the programme on Monday, along with, extraordinarily, the Pet Shop Boys and Madeleine Albright. That's your lineup for Monday's programme.
That's a packed programme.
That's not
tonight.
Bad, is it? Really?
That really is good.
I don't know what we'll podcast from that. Maybe the whole thing.
The whole thing with Chinaglia, who I had never seen before, but he's terrific. I mean, he comes on and people come on and say terrible things about him. They say, oh, yes, well, he undermined team spirit and he took over. And the thing that he appeared to be able to do was to score lots and lots of goals and get lots of people's backs up. And then he defends himself against all these charges by saying, yes, well, you know, they are just annoyed because I scored all these goals. And then they want to tell me what to do. And he's a real character. And they've got a real find in his interview. And the nice thing about the documentary is it doesn't pussyfoot around the disputes within the team. The other nice thing about it is that if
like me, you enjoyed documentaries like Inside Deep Throat, which were like very much to do with New York 1970s, that whole kind of subculture. There's a lot of that going on in this. It's not a sports documentary. It's much more a cultural phenomenon documentary, as is, you know, indicated by the fact that the guy who set up the football team in the first place was from Warner Communications. So they were basically in the entertainment business rather than the sports business.
By the way, the Bruce Springsteen concert, the Seeger Sessions concert, which I mentioned last week because it was on the radio last week, it's on BBC Four tonight,
right,
and it's on BBC Two tomorrow night, which you won't be able to, and it's fantastic, but you won't be able to see it because you're going to Cannes.
Yes.
Always your favourite experience of the
year. Yeah, I'm really excited about it.
Movie of the week.
Well, actually, Once in a Lifetime.